The coolest way to get through the summer heat is with a $69 AC tune-up from Vernon, the heating and cooling specialist. $69 to make sure your air conditioning is working at peak cooling. Vernon, the heating and cooling specialist. The name says it all. Because when you focus only on heating and cooling for 43 years, well, you get really good at it. And summer heat is when Vernon can show you how good with their $69 AC tune-up. Vernon, the heating and cooling specialist. Online at vernonheating.com.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Sam Madeira back here on the Dr. Madeira Show, and welcome back and welcome to new listeners. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. Tara Scott. How are you today, Dr. Scott?
Good. Happy to be here.
Yes, so glad to have you. And we met through a mentorship program, and it's been awesome getting to know each other from a distance from, you know, Seattle, and you're in Ohio.
Almost. Yeah.
Yeah, so long distance, and now you're on the show, which will be great, and you'll be able to share your knowledge and wisdom and experience with everybody. So for those of you who don't know Dr. Tara Scott, she graduated from Northeast Ohio University College of Medicine and completed her residency with Summa Health Systems at Akron City Hospital in Ohio. She recently retired from being an OBGYN after almost about 20 years focus, and now is focusing on functional medicine and integrative medicine. And she's an associate clinical professor at Northeast Ohio Medical University, where she teaches OBGYN residents. So it's great to have a specialist like yourself who has been both in the conventional medicine world as a specialist in gynecology and hormones, as well as integrative and functional medicine. And you're still, it sounds like you're still teaching in the hospital. So you're bridging this gap, which is, I think, the best of both worlds. And so thanks for the work that you do for with everybody.
Yeah, thanks.
And you also teach around the country, is that right? And I think you are teaching in Australia or something, or out of the country?
So since 2010, I teach for LP3 Network or Medisca. And so we have since the last 7 years I've been going to Australia, teaching doctors and pharmacists in Canada, Australia, and Southeast Asia. And just this year, I started also teaching for A4M, Module 1 in endocrinology and the BHRT. So a couple of different options, because I feel like if you teach people, then you can reach more people, obviously. So, and there's not really a standard in this space. So it's really important to make sure that as many people are kind of practicing evidence-based medicine in this space.
I agree. Yes. And you, so you're teaching for A4M, you're traveling around, you're running your own clinic, and you have a naturopathic doctor in your clinic. So you're well-versed in hormones and functional medicine. So it's like you're the expert of hormones and really holding down the fort there. Are most of your patients coming in with known diagnosis of a hormone issue or deficiency?
Well, I've been practicing in the same place. So mm-hmm. I've been probably doing hormones for about 15 years. So most of the people in my town know me for that. And so a lot of them will come in without a prior diagnosis, just thinking that it could be their hormones. But there's not really anyone where I am specifically that does hormones. I'm actually 40 minutes south of Cleveland Clinic. And so they have their functional medicine center, but they don't really have anyone who does hormones there. So, you know, we refer people up to them, and they refer people down to me for hormones. because it's kind of a, there's more than enough patients to go around. So most of the patients don't, I think there's still a disconnect in patients thinking what symptoms can be caused from hormones, whether it's thyroid, adrenal, female or male hormones. So I think there's still a great bit of education that needs to be done that this is what it could be. And that it doesn't mean you have to necessarily take it, but just diagnosing the issues. I think there's still a stigma that people don't want to take hormones. So that prevents them from coming in because they don't want to take anything because they're thinking about the study 17 years ago that was done on synthetic hormones.
Right. Yeah. Let's get into that maybe a little bit more before we go into some other topics. So are you talking about the Women's Health Initiative study or other studies that have come out since that were controversial in nature?
Well, the Women's Health Initiative is probably the most well-known because it was what's called a randomized placebo-controlled trial. But if you really look at the data, there was really only 16,000 people, and it was women who the average age was 65. So there have been follow-up studies with higher numbers that, you know, there, but that not randomized. There was an observational study in Europe that was 80,000 women that were 40 to 64 that also had more numbers. So it's confusing to patients because, you know, like you said, I'm bridging the gap between traditional. I'm still a member of the North American Menopause Society, which is very traditional because I want to make sure I'm abreast of all the literature. But if you see the hormone experts there, you know, they're still using that old data. And the data from the WHI has been repurposed and republished in a million different studies since then. That same cohort of 16,000 women, average age was 65. Which isn't really an appropriate age range when you're talking about most women are, you know, in their 50s, and a lot of them aren't taking hormones at 65.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And then as far as bioidenticals, what kind of research do we have currently for men and women for using bioidentical hormones? I guess we could say, you know, bias for women and progesterone for women and testosterone for men. What have you seen in the literature there that is compelling?
So the problem
potentially compelling
bioidentical hormones is it's a marketing term. And so most people, when they think of bioidentical hormones, they think of custom compounded creams. And so there are lots of FDA approved bioidentical hormones. Like you can get testosterone for men injections that are mass produced, but that's still bioidentical. You can get estrogen patches that are bioidentical. You can get micronized progesterone. So there are quite a few studies that are studying those exact preparations. There are not that many studies looking at progesterone topical. And there's also not that many studies that actually have looked at bias. There's a few studies more under the guise of how to test. There's been some that have actually been published in the journal Menopause, which is the journal of the North American Menopause Society. But part of the problem is a lot of those studies, unless you have a drug that's funded, you can't get your research funded. So for a little mom compounding pharmacist that wants, you know, to prove that they're product is safe, you know, they'd have to fund their own research. So it just, there's no profit in it. So it just doesn't get done. But we can extrapolate the same chemical structure and think about the science and the physiology and take, you know, the important information from that.
So for testosterone for men, I want to get into thyroid in a second, but just real briefly here for testosterone for men, have you seen any research that goes beyond 2 or 3 or 5 years with men on testosterone therapy, whether it's a cream or injections?
You know, that I don't know that there has been anything with long with that. And I would have to look up when was the Androgel or the commercially available testosterone actually available. And so part of the problem with the commercially available testosterone for men is it's way, way higher doses than what the normal testes would produce. 5 to 8 milligrams is what the testes produce, but yet we're giving 50 to 100 milligrams of androgel that's commercially available. Because whenever research is done, they're not monitoring it appropriately. So they're looking at testing, which does not monitor topical.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at USAA.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
Dosing. So that is a little bit of a problem and has led to a lot of men being overdosed on testosterone and such adverse cardiovascular events. And so there's been a couple trials that have been out there, and I'm sure you've seen these, like, are you on testosterone replacement? You know, look, talk to us, we're a lawyer or whatever. Did you have a heart attack? You know, so, you know, direct to consumer legal advertising. So I think there's a big misnomer then that they're trying to almost do the same thing to men that they did to women about, oh, testosterone causes this XYZ increased cardiovascular. So for women, and there was just a global consensus on testosterone, which they did review all the art, the literature that, and this was a traditional endocrinology or hormone experts that showed there is no increased risk of breast cancer or cardiovascular effects with women, but there wasn't data past, you know, like you said, two, three years. Now, I don't know if there's a global consensus coming out on men now, but that was just released last month. I think October it was published. So I don't know if they're like working on the one for men, but I think it's the same issue, is there is a disconnect on the type of, at least all the testosterone that's commercially available is bioidentical because it is chemically, structurally the same as what our bodies make, what your body make, not my body. Well, I guess my body too, but not the dosage. So it's chemically the same. So that in a sense is bioidentical. But the problem is the way it's monitored in traditional medicine, because there's so much more people, at least where I practice, that family practice doctors that are so much more ready to write testosterone for men, but not estrogen and progesterone for women.
Interesting.
So it's more kind of mainstream. Yeah. I mean, that's what I think. And so, but they're not monitoring the right way.
And so real quick, how should a patient be monitored for hormone therapies?
So it depends on how you're giving it. So obviously, if you're going to give testosterone, you could give it as a rapid dissolve tablet, which is going to go directly to your sublingual blood vessels and into your blood system. You could give it as an injection, which is going to go through your muscles into your blood system. You could give it as a topical gel. If you give it as a topical gel, it's going to permeate through your skin. It's going to go leak into the capillaries and the blood there. But it's not going to be distributed back through the venous blood until it goes through the body one time. So what ends up happening is it gets disseminated through the lymphatics. We don't monitor the lymphatic levels. So I actually just had like this big discussion with David Zava of ZRT, who's one of the saliva testing labs that we use. Mm-hmm. And so quite a bit of research on different types of testing. You know, there is like when you poke your finger, that's considered blood spot testing. So you're actually getting the capillary blood. So you could do a topical dose and do that. But when we do serum testing, it's not the blood that's going to your tissues. It's what's already been distributed. So that'd be like if you were a disgruntled UPS driver and you said, I have too many packages. And I said, okay, Sam, come back to the station when you're done and let me look in your truck. You came back and I said, there's no packages in your truck, so you don't have a lot to deliver. You would tell me, I've already delivered packages, right? So that's like the venous blood does not have the testosterone in it. So when we're putting it on our skin, we're looking in the regular blood testing, which is venous blood. And then there's this theory that, well, we're actually spinning off the red blood cell, and how much is actually on the red blood cell? Some of it isn't. So blood testing is fine if you're doing a what's called a rapid dissolve tablet. You got to make sure you really dissolve that though, because we really don't like to give testosterone orally, because as it goes orally, it has a negative effect on your blood clotting proteins and your cholesterol and your lipids. So if you're giving an IM, you could time regular serum testing because you're going to see that in the blood. So it really depends on how you choose to give it, how you decide to monitor it. But most of what I see in family practice around regionally where I am, it's topical dosing and serum testing, which doesn't really work.
So to summarize, if you're going to do topical dosing, then there should be saliva testing, not serum. Is that what you're getting at there?
Blood spot, which is dried blood spot. So like just like a diabetic would check their blood sugar with a finger prick, you could also check that. The problem with urine testing, because I know urine testing where you're from is also there, the labs are all over there, it's underestimated in urine. So if you give topical doses, because if you put it on your skin, what's going the urine, the blood vessels. So the testes is making testosterone. It's going to the blood. It's filtrated through to the kidney and into the urine. So you're not getting the peripheral. You're not getting the tissue. So, you know, in the case of women, it's a little bit different because our testosterone, most of it comes from what we call peripheral conversion. So that comes from an adrenal source in your muscle and fat being converted to testosterone. Men, obviously, most of it's going to come from the testes. So it's a little bit different monitoring men. And you're still going to look at, you could look at epitestosterone versus testosterone, and one of them will go up with hormone replacement for men and another won't. So there are some newer options and assays coming out to monitor male testosterone hormone replacement, which is good.
Exciting. And when do you think those will be out? The end of next year or sometime next year or the year after?
So I know, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to say, because like I said, I just had a big phone conference with Dr. Ozawa. So I know they're doing some newer things and some serum testing at his lab at ZRT, which is in Beaverton. They do saliva, they do urine, they do blood spot. You know, so there's definitely, you know, if you're going to use topical, now if you're using a rapid dissolve tablet, and you have a really good patient who's really going to dissolve it and not chew it and swallow it, because they, you know how people do it. They let it dissolve for a little bit and then they kind of get tired, chew it and swallow it. So they're really getting some of it. And then some of the purists would say, how much are you really swallowing of that saliva that's in your mouth? You know, so are you really getting 100% of that dosage sublingual or right to your blood system? So those things, or a troche, rapid dissolves quicker. A troche would take a little bit longer. It's not a lozenge, but it's like you would think is a lozenge, but it's not the same thing if you talk to a pharmacist. That could do serum testing, but you've got to time it. You got to think about it. Well, I'm going to give it here and I'm going to take the blood here. So it's, you know, you got to be really careful for a lot of hormones and mindful about when you give it and when you're dosing it. Same like for thyroid too. When did you take your thyroid versus when you drew the blood?
Well said. Yeah, it is definitely a nuanced specialty. So it's good to have your expertise shared today on the podcast. And as far as thyroid, I think that's a good segue into thyroid. It seems like most people today and for a long time now have had low thyroid issues. And what percent of your practice are you seeing low thyroid? And are you seeing it mostly in women or men or both?
Well, the problem with thyroid is that, you know, our organs don't work in isolation. So the thyroid is absolutely affected by your cortisol and your adrenal gland. So basically, you know, you have your TSH, which comes from your pituitary gland, and that's all that traditional doctors monitor. That's a pituitary hormone. That's not a thyroid hormone. And so the pituitary hormone stimulates your thyroid to make thyroid hormone, but that's not the end of the story. Your body has to convert it to T3. So it's like if I gave you a paycheck. That paycheck itself doesn't do anything. You got to cash it to be able to use it to buy something. Just that piece of paper isn't going to help you, right? So the T4, which is what we traditionally give people to replace it, levothyroxine, Synthroid, Levoxyl, your body has to convert it to T3, which is what's metabolically active. And that happens in the periphery, you know, in your cells. So we see a lot of patients in our practice that they might have an okay T4, and their TSH might even be okay, but because of the effect of low vitamin D, which I'm sure is the same in the Pacific Northwest, low ferritin, high or low cortisol, that convert.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded. I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
Conversion to T3 isn't happening. And a lot of the traditional practitioners that I see don't check. They usually just check the TSH. Maybe they'll check a free T3 or 3T4, but they don't usually check the free T3. In women, estrogen further can affect it because estrogen affects the binding protein. Now, in men, it does happen as well, but you know, with testosterone abnormalities and sex hormone binding globulin, usually in men you're seeing lower sex hormone binding globulin because testosterone has that effect. But if you have metabolic syndrome, if you have testosterone turning into estrogen, which it does for men, and I think that's the other problem, is that people aren't monitoring that. There's an enzyme called aromatase that I've had a lot of patients have a genetic alteration, so they favor turning it into estrogen rather than dihydrotestosterone. If you have that and you're not monitoring the estrone in men and women, you know, it doesn't matter what amount of testosterone you get if your body's not getting it as dihydrotestosterone. So a lot of times that will affect the binding protein of thyroid, meaning that more of it is stored up. So the binding protein is kind of like your 401k. You can't get to that money, whereas the free thyroid hormone is like your cash. So that's what you need to use. So if you have a lot of thyroid hormone, but your binding protein is putting it away in your 401k and you can't touch that, it doesn't do you any good to have it. I mean, you have it for later. So that's what I see with a lot of people with thyroid. So a lot of it has to do with cortisol. Now, there's a fair amount of gut dysfunction that's also affecting thyroid, especially if it's autoimmune, Hashimoto's. So we'll see that as well. And so I think just because of our bad diet and our stress that everybody has, more and more and more people are having what we call subclinical hypothyroidism, but it's usually secondary to something else.
And so when would you just work, not just, but when would you kind of partition patient groups off into, we're going to work on your gut, we're going to replete iron deficiencies if there's iron deficiencies or iron deficiency anemia, and folate, B12, you mentioned a lot of nutrients that help with conversion of T4 to T3, and work on more of a solely natural approach versus say, okay, now we need to give you T3 or T4 or both, whether it's compounded or it's, you know, WP thyroid or Armour thyroid or a true generic Synthroid or leothyronine prescription. So when do you go to prescription and when do you say, we are going to stay over here and work on your gut for, you know, a while? And after you've worked on natural things, do you ever say, okay, this, we got this far here, now we're going to add in a prescription? So I'm curious, like, what's the tipping point there?
Well, you naturopathic doctors have the benefit of that's how you're trained, you know, so you already know, you got to look in the gut, you got to look at the cause. I mean, it's second nature to you. For me, remember, I was very traditionally trained for the first, you know, 7 to 10 years of my practice. So it's so hard to resist writing that prescription for thyroid. So it depends on the clinical situation. Usually what we're doing is we're doing side by side. I mean, if it's truly underactive, a patient has a really low thyroid hormone out of the range, not out of the optimal range, but out of the normal range, a lot of times I will prescribe. I always start with really low dose thyroid at the same time as working on the adrenals and the gut, not offering a prescription instead of, just because, to be honest, maybe you guys see more patients that are more motivated to clean up their diet and decrease their stress first. So we're seeing these people who are like in the hamster wheel and they don't have a lot of control over what they can control, but you got to get them feeling better first. And then once they start having more energy, then they can go exercise and, you know, work on their gut and everything. So we try to do it on a side-by-side basis, not one or the other. And certainly a lot of times, if it's very clear that it's not primarily the thyroid and it's adrenal, we will work on that first in the gut.
Yeah, that's a great summary as far as, you know, holistic endocrinology seems like it's needed in so many situations today where, unfortunately, most patients aren't exposed to this and it's such a new thing for them. So oftentimes are wondering like how do vitamins and lifestyle, like why does that matter? I'm going to work my three jobs and, you know, run three companies and, you know, eat my French fries and drink my beer when I want to. And it's a constant, I think it's a constant re-education, because a lot of the times people, and I would say especially men, are the last to admit, okay, this actually is affecting something, even if I don't know exactly what it is, because I'm not forced to pay attention to my body every month, like women who are having a menstrual cycle for, you know, years and decades. It's different, you know, it's a different paradigm for men to say, okay, like what's going on with my body? And I don't understand this, and these symptoms don't make sense, and I can't really articulate what's going on here, but something's off. What the heck is it? And okay, it's hormones, but I can't just chew on some thyroid pills in the morning and inject testosterone and keep just working myself to death, you know? So it's definitely different. So do you see that once people get on thyroid medication that they're able to have more motivation and more energy to do things like exercise or cook a meal a couple times a week for themselves?
I would say the majority of the people, like I said, if they're motivated to change their diet and their stress level, do get a little bit of a reprieve when we start the thyroid while working on everything else. But like anything, if someone's dumping trash up the river and you just kick the trash out, and you're not looking to see who's dumping it, you're just going to keep taking that trash out, right? So I think it depends on the person. I mean, if you look at the traditional guidelines, they say that a TSH that's abnormal from 5 to 10, don't treat. That's subclinical hyperthyroidism. So why have a normal range if you're not going to follow it? But that's what our traditional counterparts are doing. These people have abnormal TSHs and they're not recommending treatment. So a lot of times, because people are so worn down and everything, and it's a vicious cycle, if I feel that it's abnormal enough. If it's not abnormal, I'll tell them, you know, your thyroid's not optimal. I'll give you like a C. Let's work on these things and let's follow your thyroid hormones again in 4 to 6 months, you know, because the reason why you're not getting a better grade on your thyroid is because of what you're eating, is because of this, because of that. So, you know, like anything, I'm sure it's the same there too. You've got your motivated patients and you've got your patients that still kind of want a quick fix. I mean, I think as an MD, maybe more would gravitate to an MD because that's how patients are educated. And if they're seeking out a naturopathic doctor, they know that, you know, that's going to be your approach. In Ohio, naturopathic doctors can't prescribe. Mm-hmm. So going to a naturopathic doctor, in Ohio, they'll know they're going to get a holistic approach first.
I see. So it's a little bit more black and white, whereas in Washington State and Montana State, where I'm licensed, you know, I can prescribe hormones and some other medications as needed. Mm-hmm. So with the current patients coming in, I'm curious how often you're seeing progesterone deficiencies. It was another topic that we were going to discuss today for everybody, since it seems like a lot of the focus for men and women is testosterone for men, estrogen for women, you know, repleting those deficiencies, optimizing those hormones. But progesterone kind of seems like the unknown hormone in the group for the most part, for the common person coming into your office. So when would we want to look into progesterone for women?
All the time, 100% of the time. I would say that is the most prescribed hormone that I prescribe. For men, you know, it depends on who you talk to. I've heard experts say that, no, there isn't any, you know, maybe a whisper of progesterone, but there's not really any benefit to treating men with progesterone. I've heard a few say it could be beneficial. So it's kind of been mixed as far as what I've heard from the experts. But I would say that is the biggest problem with women is estrogen dominance, either premenopausal or postmenopausal. A lot of women are able to make estrogen, specifically estrone, even without ovaries, but they're not able to make progesterone if they're not ovulating or they don't have good quality follicles. So most, I would say, like 80, probably 75, 80% of my patients are low in progesterone.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of men have never heard about progesterone, or they don't know why they would need to take it. And a lot of women seem today, like you're saying, are deficient in progesterone, and they think maybe it's estrogen, but it's actually progesterone. And then that seems to help a lot of their symptoms. Are you seeing complete symptom resolution with progesterone replacement therapy?
So for most women, perimenopausal, that's what they need. And so because it's a moving target, and the fact that every month you could have a different balance of estrogen, I would say the majority of women get an improvement. A lot of them do get complete resolution, but some of them, as they have a different amount of estrogen every month, don't always get 100% repletion. For men and progesterone, I could see a couple reasons why people would use it. One is because it does compete at the 5-alpha reductase, which is what testosterone converts to dihydrotestosterone. So if you're someone that you're worried about that conversion, that would be one thing that it would do. And if you're somebody who has too much estrogen as a male that you're aromatizing, progesterone does downregulate the estrogen receptor. But other than that, I mean, usually what you would probably want to take a different approach, like blocking aromatase or fostering their estrogen metabolism, cleaning up their gut, you know, everything that you mentioned with stress and diet and everything. Probably would be my preference prior to the progesterone for men. For women, you know, a lot of times you definitely need to do that. And you're still working on the same things like gut and estrogen metabolism and stress. But because progesterone starts to decline over 35, a lot of people, even with that in their 40s, they still need to have some supplementation.
And have you ever seen progesterone be helpful for other cases, like neurological cases, whether it be seizures or head injuries or things like that? What other conditions might you prescribe progesterone for in this case?
So progesterone is neuroprotective, and there are some studies of using progesterone higher doses for head injury. So I don't think that's standard of care. And I know there's also been some reports of using that IV in the ER for head injury. I have a couple patients in my practice, younger girls with seizures, pseudo seizures, specifically that I'm treating with progesterone, and they're having a resolution of symptoms. One of them is actually coming in this week for her Dutch results. So that, and clearly that was her presenting symptom, was the seizure-like activity. One of them, she didn't have abnormal EEG. The other one was more of a syncopal. So progesterone actually agonizes a receptor, a GABA receptor, one of the metabolites receptor. So which it is, it's inhibitory, meaning it's relaxing. So if seizures are thought to be more glutamate discharge, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, then giving more of the GABA can help that. So I don't think it's something that's used really commonly for those symptoms, but I think more and more I'm seeing women specifically with those symptoms, neurological symptoms, whether it be migraines, pseudo seizures, syncopal episodes, that if you take a detailed history, there is a cyclical occasion of that. So this one patient, like I said, that I'm seeing this week, we did a Dutch test, and she's got crazy estrogen dominance. So it'll be interesting to see how she responds. Now, the other patient that I was working with was a younger girl too, a teenager. And so she did have a resolution, but she's still anovulatory. So it's not, everything hasn't really regulated yet.
And then as far as conditions, like we consulted on a case of catamenial epilepsy. I consulted with you about a female patient, relatively young, you know, mid-20s, and she had catamenial epilepsy. And you were mentioning for her Prometrium, which is the, you know, basically the manufactured
oral micronized progesterone, right?
Yeah. So oral micronized progesterone. And as you were saying in the beginning, it is bioidentical, which is kind of like this buzz name now. But it is something that you would get instead of from a compounding pharmacy, you would get from a retail pharmacy, just so the listener knows. But in that case, you know, I think you mentioned a specific dosage. Maybe we can share that dosage with the audience just as a case example. And is this something that most endocrinologists or OBGYN specialists would know about? Or is this something that you're seeing that you've learned more by being part of A4M and a functional medical doctor?
Yeah, traditional doctors won't know the difference. And as a matter of fact, they don't even understand the difference between oral micronized progesterone and medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is synthetic progestin. And that's what a lot of the data has looked at. And so the way I explain it to OBs is, well, first of all, if I was talking to you, Sam, and you had a patient that was a diabetic and his blood sugar was 30 and he was going to pass out, would you give him Splenda?
I mean, if he's going to pass out, yeah, I would try to get his blood sugar up, but not Splenda. But
Splenda help him. No, Splenda has zero calories. It is an artificial sweetener. Yeah. Give him glucose, right?
Yep.
So the same thing is that, you know, progesterone, the reason why MPA or medroxyprogesterone acetate was actually created was because way back in the 1940s, we gave estrogen only because they couldn't figure out how to micronize progesterone. So it took 2,500 pregnant pig ovaries to make 1 milligram of progesterone. And we give 100 milligrams a night. So not that I love pigs or anything, but that's a lot of pigs to slaughter to get 100 milligrams to give daily. The studies are on 100 and 200, which is what's commercially available. And so when we say Prometrium, that's the trade name, micronized progesterone is the generic name. What that means is they mass produce it. It is bioidentical, but it's not slow release. It's immediate release. And initially when it was marketed, it was in peanut oil, which is kind of stupid with all the peanut allergies. So I do believe maybe the generic is not in peanut oil, but it's still an immediate release. So the pharmacokinetics are different in your body. If you take something and you get, like if I'm watering my plants and I dump all the water for the whole week in one day, how much can that plant really absorb? Well, that's the same with this immediate release progesterone. Some people are fine. Some people can, and they just, you know, they have side effects. So the doctors that I work with do not understand the Splenda glucose thing. Now, when I explain to them that we actually give progesterone in reproductive cycles, in first trimester pregnancy, we give injections weekly for preterm labor of 17-hydroxyprogesterone caprate. And I say, if it's the same thing, would you give them MPA? And they look at me like, no, it's teratogenic, meaning it causes birth defects. It's category X in safety. So if they're not the same thing, that one we would give to our unborn child week after week in pregnancy, but the other one you wouldn't give, then why are we giving day after day after day in hormone replacement therapy of this synthetic version versus giving the micronized progesterone and any other? It's just like, you're too young, Sam, but I remember when I was training.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
We give beef and pork insulin. So people would use that, diabetics, and they'd give it and they'd get these little wheals and these allergic response because it was beef and pork insulin, because we hadn't discovered how to make human recombinant insulin. Now we know. So it's the same thing with thyroid. Thyroid is bioidentical hormones. The difference is in the incipient, and the incipient is what else is in that capsule. So basically they have to put filler. A lot of times it's lactose. And a lot of people have dairy allergies or dairy intolerances. They might put cellulose in it. They might put other things in it, but it's commercially made and mass produced. And with thyroid, most of it's immediate release. With oral progesterone, when you compound it, we have the option of slowing it down so your body absorbs it better. So there's a lot of nuances that really just help a personalized approach to somebody instead of just giving, you know, everybody a one size fits all. And I think that's part of the problem we got into with hormones in general, is you might be able to do one size fits all for blood pressure or for, you know, cholesterol even, but you can't hormones, endogenous, people don't have the same endogenous hormone levels, nor do they have the same metabolism. So one woman who's 125 pounds, the next one who's 250 pounds, they're not going to metabolize hormones the same, and their endogenous hormones aren't going to be the same. Same for men and testosterone, you know? So I don't think we can really treat it the same as we would if we're giving you a blood pressure medicine or a cholesterol medicine. It has to be individualized, and you have to take into consideration that person's endogenous levels, what their body's making, and how they metabolize them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And what I often see with male hormones is that it has to do with activity too, as well as sexual activity. So if someone's, you know, training for a marathon, and then they may need more testosterone. Or if they're, you know, working out CrossFit or something, and then they do that for 6 months, and then they get injured, and they're out for 2 months or a month, they might need less while they're not as active, but they still need a little bit, and actually might help them recover faster from that injury. So it is such a nuanced thing. And I liked what you said in the beginning about the conventional medical community not knowing how to test things sufficiently or as frequently with the right kind of testing. And unfortunately, what I still see, even at some of these so-called low testosterone clinics or low T clinics in the greater Seattle area, is that they're testing their hormones once or twice a year. And they're, you know, it's a very affordable price point. But unfortunately, in the US, you get what you pay for on pretty much every account. So, you know, if you want to play Russian roulette with a DEA controlled substance like testosterone, like you're saying, that does have serious side effects potentially if it's not being dosed correctly. And if it's being underdosed, it can be horrible because you're, you know, it's enough to slow down your own production of testosterone, but it's not enough to give you the benefits. So you can feel horrible, or it's too much, and then you get a bunch of side effects, whether it's hair loss, or you can have, you know, acne all over your back, which isn't really fun, like really horrible acne. You can have exasperations of prostate if you have already a large prostate. You could also have heart issues or throw a clot and get a pulmonary embolism. So that doesn't happen to everybody, but those are real risks. And they are, you know, from what I've seen in my time period working with men, uncommon when you're using low dose prescriptions and you're testing frequently. And then some of the nice things today is that we have these cardiometabolic labs. So we can test for clotting genetics. We can test, you know, for example, factor laden five and prothrombin or factor two. So if somebody has those genetics, I tell them, you're not getting testosterone. Not for me anyway, because most likely, especially with an injection, you're more likely to throw a clot. And especially if you're not taking a blood thinner like warfarin or another similar medication, and then there's some drug-drug interactions with testosterone and warfarin. So it is such a nuanced field that if somebody doesn't have these kind of like checkpoints along the way and they're not getting tested on a fairly regular basis, then it does become a liability for the patient. And a potential issue, or you know, you could have even just like water retention or swelling in your ankles if something's going on awry with the prescription. And I'm in a lot of like Facebook groups for testosterone and hormone optimization, as I know you are, and I see people asking some pretty shocking questions. I'm not sharing names or anything, keeping everybody confidential, but it is shocking to still see things happening the way they are happening with doctors and patients, whether it's just not being heard. Most of the time what I hear is men are not being heard when they go to an endocrinologist or a medical doctor and say, or whether a primary care nurse practitioner and say, hey,
you know, I don't feel good. I don't feel like myself. I don't know what's going on, but I want you to check my testosterone. And then they check their levels and then they say, oh, well, everything's within normal limits. You're fine. And their testosterone is 350. And 350 used to be the bottom of the barrel 6 years ago for LabCorp. And now it's 250 or 275 or something. So they, you know, if we talk about, you're talking about thyroid lab tests, and we can go back to that as an example too, with TSH and whatnot and T4 and T3, but there's the so-called normal range. And then there's, you know, these optimal ranges that people at A4M and other organizations have found that through the research that, and going back in time to when we first started testing hormones, when we first figured out how to test them, in, I think when they first tested testosterone, it was the 40s or 50s. So we have information that testosterone, total testosterone range actually used to go up to about, I believe it was 1500, or at least double what it is now. So that was the 1950s. And if you look at that generation and what they were able to accomplish and what they did accomplish, it was pretty spectacular. And
the problem is with what the labs are doing is they're basing their normal ranges based on population studies. They're taking the range and they're doing a standard deviation, right? And so if all of a sudden more people are getting testosterone tested and they have lower testosterone, instead of saying the country's sicker, let's change the normal range because of median, mean, whatever, mode, standard deviation, because our normal range, it's the same thing with progesterone. The normal lab used to be, you know, 10 to 28 for progesterone. Now it's 1.6, which is the same as it is in the follicular phase, which means there's no increase in progesterone with ovulation. So it sounds like for men and testosterone, they did the same thing. They moved the normal range because more people are getting their testosterone checked and more people are coming up with abnormal testosterone. That doesn't mean the standard deviation, you know, should be changed, because it should be done on a healthy population. And then that's where we should do it. So now we've got more sicker people in this population, and now let's change the normal range. The same thing with this, the normal age for puberty. They're saying, oh, it's earlier and earlier because more people are having it earlier. Well, that doesn't mean it's normal. It's insanity, you know?
Yeah, that is wild. I like what you mentioned about the, I don't like that it's happening, but I like that you mentioned that it's a population study. And interesting fact nuance in that, when you look at, for example, Cleveland Heart Lab, which is near you in Cleveland, Ohio, and then Boston Heart Lab, which is outside of Boston, Massachusetts, these are cardiometabolic lab tests that are testing people that have cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, et cetera. So their top of the range for testosterone doesn't go past, for total testosterone, doesn't go past 836, I believe, doesn't even hit 850. And I've been reading or consuming, I guess, listening to the book Estrogen Generation by Dr. Anthony Jay, and he's a chemist, and he talks all about estrogen, xenoestrogens in the air, food, and water, and how there's this fertility issue in men with less sperm, and how, you know, he mentioned 800 would be the kind of optimal, roughly optimal for total testosterone. You know, if someone's kind of like 50 points either side, I think they're still okay for a morning blood test for total testosterone. And he was also mentioned, he was the one who was mentioning in the 1950s, and I had heard this before reading his book, but he mentions it in his book. So if you want to go read it or listen to it, for the listeners, check it out. Anthony Jay, PhD. But he does talk about the fertility issues in men and women. So maybe you can, maybe we can dive deeper into that with progesterone. So you were talking about how the range used to go up to 10 or so, and now it's 1.6 for progesterone. And so they're saying it's basically not going to spike, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not going to spike so that women can have enough progesterone to ovulate. So then we're seeing kind of this flattening of progesterone for women who should be childbearing age, hence this infertility epidemic. Is that kind of, am I piecing it together for the listeners correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically what you said about men is the same with women. It's the environment, it's the effect of stress and diet is affecting our hormones. And then we're not taught how to do this in medical school or residency. And then the changing of the lab normals. So that now if you're somebody who's just like, okay, I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to check something before you do any, like, unless you're doing a deep dive into functional medicine training, like you said, I'm going to look at progesterone. Oh, it's normal. It's 3, which, you know, if you actually thought about it, it should be higher after the release of the egg, because that's the definition of the menstrual cycle. But again, unless you're really, it takes a lot of time to really relearn these things, at least if you're trained traditionally. It may be different with naturopathic school, but we're not really taught to analyze things that way. We're taught that, what does the patient present with? Rule out this, rule out this, rule out this. Okay, they don't have a heart attack, they don't have cancer, they don't have this. Here's the treatment algorithm. We're not taught to think about why are they having that symptom or what the root is. So it's a total different way for us to think about it. And so the people who are doing research with me, most of it is going to be the traditional doctors, you know. So it's going to be the people who are even advising for drug companies and everything. So it's just the whole system. But I think the change is being driven by the patients. And I think now with social media, I mean, a lot of people in our space and our industry are on social media, are writing books. People can get information. And maybe before, I mean, honestly, like when I started this, I mean, couldn't get the information. Because I started doing this in 2003, 2004. Were you even out of medical school then, Sam? I don't know.
2003? No, yeah. I was... 2003, I was in college, but I had gotten my wilderness EMT in high school. So that's kind of how I started. And I wanted, actually, it's interesting because your husband's an ER doc. So I was thinking about being an ER doc or a surgeon. So I was spending my time. I graduated high school actually early. And then I spent almost 3 months in the ER 2 days a week, the OR 1 or 2 days a week, and then the ambulance 2 days a week. And I really liked the ER. I did not like hospital politics and bureaucracy and the lights and the crappy food. And so I decided after watching a bunch of general surgeries, I saw above the knee amputation for a something 70-something year old male. I can't remember. It was 2001. But I got to see a lot of cool stuff. Gallbladder surgery, removal, hernia, just some basic stuff, but also some pretty cool stuff. And I decided that I didn't want to be in that system. And that was kind of like enough sampling for me. So I decided not to become a medical doctor after that. But yeah, there's definitely an age gap between us.
Yeah, but okay.
Not age gap, but the maybe a half a generation or a quarter generation. Yeah.
The point is that what you have available now to you or to patients or whatever with social media, with, you know, WebMD, with just the internet. I mean, can you believe there was no internet when I was in medical school? You know, we actually had to go to the card catalog is. I mean, we had to go to the library and look in a card catalog to find whatever references we had.
Yeah, so it's a different world.
Different world, and so it's good and bad. You know, obviously the bad is the toxins, the environment, but the good is the information is there, you know. So that can help patients drive this movement of, you know, demanding or self-selecting to see a naturopathic doctor like you in the Pacific Northwest versus a traditionally trained doctor, you know. So, and especially since where you practice, you can prescribe, you can do all those things, you can order testing, you know, so the patients have that option in your geographic area.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I think it's definitely, like you said, it is a double-edged sword because you get kind of like the biohacker, the experimenter that's experimenting on themselves. And I did that for years until I got a root cause diagnosis. And I think it gets really expensive and you can't see everything when you're being your own doctor, even if you are a doctor. And sometimes it's worse if you are a doctor, because then you look like a hypochondriac that's just like on steroids, where you're just doing too much and your friends kind of look at you like you're an alien. So I think, you know, I always say, as a doctor, I hired a doctor. I've hired a health coach in the past. I've, you know, worked with personal trainers. So I recommend people hire experts, work with someone like Dr. Tara Scott or myself, or if, you know, you're not near us and you're looking for someone that does something similar to us. Dr. Scott teaches for A4M, so she has that network available to her. You can look on A4M and interview them and figure out if they're a good fit for you. The other real quick, maybe not real quick, but the other topic I wanted to get into, since it is, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up this Thursday, it's Monday before Thanksgiving, and then there's going to be the holidays, whether you celebrate Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or whatever. And then New Year's, and a lot of cultures celebrate New Year's more than Christmas. Basically, what this equates to is a lot of people eating a lot of sugar, drinking a lot of alcohol. And maybe we can talk about how alcohol plays into hormones and, you know, what dose is acceptable or kind of too much within reason. Because I think some people think it's an all or nothing thing where, you know, you can kind of, I think people should be allowed to celebrate responsibly and enjoy alcohol with their friends and family, as long as it's not like becoming a daily thing. So I'm curious where you stand on that and what you've seen in people's labs, because I'm often talking to men about, you know, cutting back a little bit, and often met with resistance and women too about, okay, well, I don't want to decrease my alcohol intake, or I don't want to take 2 weeks off twice a year or something like that. So what are you seeing with your patients in Ohio through the years?
Well, so there's a couple things there. One is that we always think about, when we think about hormones, we always think about breast cancer. So what does the literature say about alcohol and breast cancer? And so if you look at the study, they actually say that one glass of alcohol per day, which is 7 drinks a week, which is a lot, I think, does not increase your risk of breast cancer. But if you're looking at something like brain, then no alcohol. You should have no alcohol if you're having any kind of cognitive issues or cognitive decline, brain injury, anything. So it really depends on what your underlying pathology or disease process is. As far as the concern of how it metabolizes your hormones, there's a couple things. First of all, some people have genetic mutations in alcohol dehydrogenase. So that's one of the reasons why somebody could drink 3 drinks. And if I had 3 drinks, I'd be like, you know, I cannot hold my liquor. And so I know that. And so I rarely drink. But so alcohol, I know I have an alcohol dehydrogenase SNP, so I don't metabolize it as efficiently. When you drink a lot of alcohol, that does slow down your estrogen metabolism. I can't tell you the direct pathophysiology. I can tell you that, you know, it's a biochemistry thing, or it's anecdotally that we'll see. So there's a couple things that happen. That one is that it does slow down your estrogen when you have, you know, even more than 7 drinks, or that's even if you drink on socially on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, 3 drinks each, 4 drinks each, that's going to be more than that. The second thing is the actual effect of alcohol and the sugars in it and the effect on your insulin and your cortisol. So you're drinking most of the time at night. And so most people think that when they drink, they can fall asleep better, but then it spikes your blood sugar, it spikes your insulin. So when sugar goes up, insulin goes up to get the insulin down, and cortisol is going to be affected by insulin because cortisol and insulin affect each other. So then you have actually poor sleep, and cortisol affects your estrogen. It will slow down you getting rid of estrogen. So I do think people should be able to drink responsibly and enjoy a cocktail. Some people will find out, you know, I cannot do the sugar in cocktails. I got to just do wine. A lot of people who are not doing gluten can't have beer. So I think it makes a difference to the patient, whether it's, you know, red wine, white wine, hard liquor, you know, beer, whatever, cocktail, that sometimes it's the sugar in the mixers, versus, you know, what your end point is with health. And I think, like you said, drinking responsibly and, you know, moderation for most people could be okay.
So if you take a 200-pound man who's, let's say, you know, 45 or 50-ish, and they're drinking more than 10 drinks a week, you know, what does the medical literature say about that? Is there a concern for prostate cancers? Or, and I have seen, just to go back for a second, I have seen multiple times men drinking sometimes just two drinks. It doesn't seem like a lot to some men, but it seems like maybe a lot to us. Two drinks a night, and their estrogen's through the roof. So that is something I've seen and read over and over again, and from different resources for hormone health. So if you want to help your estrogen balance and your testosterone estrogen ratio, cut back. And then, so my question is, what do we know in the literature for men's hormone health, if at all, is the kind of ideal cutoff point for alcohol?
So there was a study, and I don't have it at my fingertips. I think it was in Harvard Health's review, and it was like a couple of years ago, that looked at four health habits and the risk of cancer. So one was, you know, 150 minutes of exercise a week. It was non-smoking. For men, it was two drinks a day, and women was two drinks a day per, you know, day. So 14 drinks a week. For women, it was one drink a day. And it was keeping your BMI less than 27.5, which is outside of the normal range. And in that cohort that they've had those four lower risks, they had a lower risk of certain cancers, including prostate, lung, renal, and pancreatic cancer, and ovarian, which are killers, you know, which, so that was surprising. And so when I give a talk about cancer, I usually cite that so I could dig out the resource and the slide if I needed to. But it always shocks me that if you just tell people, okay, keep your BMI less than 27.5, and for men, two drinks a day, that's a lot. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, a lot of men don't drink every single day. I mean, maybe right. They do, maybe dinner, but you're talking about maybe definitely weekends, maybe like they're having business meals or whatever and having a drink. But I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't see the normal would be two drinks every day, every single day. So that's 14 drinks a week you have to play with, you know? So yeah. Keeping my low non-smoking, which I would think a lot of people are not smoking now. I would say we've made some progress on that. And then the exercise, 150 minutes a week, which isn't a lot. So that is not, that's not a study you hear broadcasted, which is shocking. I think people would want to know, hey, I can decrease my risk of cancer, including pancreatic cancer, which is a killer, if I just do these four things. But so I do think, yes. And I think probably because alcohol does have to be detoxified, we talk about phase one and phase two detoxification. That's the same way that, these steroid hormones, estrogen and testosterone, have to be detoxified in the liver. So there's that connection there. So I think that, but it's so interesting to me too, because if you think about European cultures where they probably have a drink every day, they just drink wine. What is it? Is it the genetics that those genetics of those people can metabolize it and Americans can't? We didn't grow. Tolerance, what is it? It's super interesting because you probably don't see that. I mean, if you've looked at the work of Dr. Walter Longo and the, you know, the blue zones, they're not excluding alcohol. And these are people who a higher percentage live above 100. So
it's a valid point. Yeah, I have read that the whole wine a glass a day was actually 4 ounces. 4 to 6 ounces was kind of the actual dosage of red wine to get the benefits of wine. And then the other issue that's come to light is that most wine in the U.S., at least all California wines, has glyphosate, which is a herbicide. Roundup is the, you know, sales name, if you will, sold at Home Depot and whatnot. And we've seen it connected to breast cancers and specifically lymphomas. So more so, I think, statistically in lymphomas for people who are exposed over years or decades, you know, like a groundskeeper who is dying from lymphoma in the Northern Bay Area, who had the lawsuit against Monsanto. So I think that was last year. But basically, it does seem like there is a healthy limit, you know, 14 drinks for the average adult. And of course, you know, no, if you're like 5'1" and you weigh 110 pounds, that's probably not going to be 14 drinks would probably send you over the moon. But so, yeah, you know how you respond to alcohol. And then sugar, it seems, you know, holidays, it's just hard to not indulge basically from Halloween, Thanksgiving, all the way through New Year's. And I hear a lot of parents say weeks after, you know, we're past Halloween, but for the sake of the future, parents eating their kids' Halloween candy and trying not to do that. And then there's the leftover pies and whatnot from Thanksgiving and all that good stuff. And I love a good pumpkin or pecan pie. What are your kind of recommendations to help people mitigate, you know, going overboard there or potentially gaining unwanted weight and pushing that kind of metabolic syndrome pathways?
Well, believe it or not, I am a sucker for sugar. It is like I can pass up the alcohol, the whatever. I love to exercise, but I was raised to emotionally eat. I'm telling you, I want to reward myself. I had a hard day today. I had like 3 caramels, which I normally don't have any sugar at all, but it was a bad day, like I said. So for sure, you know, I feel like if you are someone and you're at a party and you, because I do this a lot, I won't drink or I maybe won't have dessert, and people kind of look at you like they aren't applauding your choices. They're scrutinizing your choices, because if you're, you know, they're like, oh, she won't eat that, she won't eat that, whatever. So unfortunately, society is not in favor yet of the health. So your question was, I'm agreeing with you. Yes, we're very susceptible to all these from things from Halloween on. So what I normally do after Thanksgiving is I do like a detox, or last year I did Prolon, or I do a 5-day reset. But one of the conferences I went to from IFM, the GI module, said that even 3 days of a plant-based whole food diet can reset your microbiome, and that's the bacteria in your gut. So our practice is going to do a 5-day challenge next week. And so we'll see who's going to do it. And it's going to be, you know, beat the holiday bloat, banish the holiday bloat. And so let people enjoy their Thanksgiving. And then we have 5 days, Monday through Friday. So you can still go to your holiday parties after that. And we're going to eliminate gluten, dairy, alcohol. I'm not going to take away caffeine, because then we'll lose some people, but sugar, and even just 5 days of it can reset those carb cravings. And so if you just say, you know, I'm going to do raw food for 5 days or 3 days, or I'm not going to, and I'm not saying meat or not meat. That's another discussion, right? I don't have actually don't have an opinion on meat or no meat. I just think a lot of plant-based diet with or without your meat for 5 days, eliminate grains, eliminate glutens, eliminate processed sugar. I'm not saying all sugar. I'm saying all processed artificial sweeteners and added sugar. So that even lets you have fruit if you want something sweet, right? So doing that after Thanksgiving, now Thanksgiving falls at the end of November. So why not think about December 2nd, second those 5 days to do it, and then it'll kind of help maybe that it will stave off and break the craving so that you head into the Christmas party season. Maybe plan to do it again in January to get back on track. So that's usually what I advise my patients. If you can't do 5 whole days, 3 days of plants will also get you there.
That's amazing that it's completely resetting the microbiome there. And as you mentioned, you still can have fruit. So, you know, I like to put organic berries in my morning smoothie with some protein powder and coconut milk and cinnamon. And cinnamon's great herb to help with sugar balance, as well as if you have a functional medicine practitioner or a clinical herbalist or doctor that can get you Gymnema, that can also help with the sugar balance. So really cut those. It's called in Ayurvedic medicine, the sugar killer. So that's what it means in, I believe, Sanskrit. So basically, you know, there's some tools for everybody to help you get through the holidays and the sugar cravings, which I'm a sugar addict too. It's a constant battle. So I grew up coming home and being home alone with my brothers and taking the Oreo, double stuffed Oreos out of the bag and, you know, eating a bunch of those and whatnot. So, yeah, we all have our vices and we're all human, even us doctors. So just do your best through the holidays, folks, and let us know what works for you. Any last parting thoughts before we close up for today's podcast?
No, I just think it's super interesting. Like, I was never even exposed to naturopathic doctors until well into my functional medicine training. So I think it's great that, you know, we can partner together and treat patients holistically. Like you said, I have a naturopathic doctor in my practice who's been phenomenal for our practice. And we definitely, you know, she's got a skill set I don't have. I've got experience and skill set she doesn't have. So we definitely are complementary. So, you know, everything that you've discussed in your approach to hormone balancing, I think is, you know, is the way to do it rather than these pop-up clinics, like you said, the testosterone clinic, low T clinics or whatever. We've got a few of them here, maybe not as many in the Midwest, but we do have them here. So you want to make sure, like you said, that you're working with the right kind of practitioner who has the right skill set as well.
Yes, definitely. And where can people find you to team up with you and your team there in Ohio? Where can they find you online?
My practice is Revitalize. And so revitalizemed.com is my website. I'm on Facebook at Revitalizemed and Instagram Revitalizemed as well. I'm on Twitter, but I never do anything on Twitter, so nothing's interesting there. But certainly post a lot of free content. Obviously, as an OBGYN, most of my patients are women, but we do have men. We do see men as well now with Dr. Sweetnich. So we're just trying to really educate. I'm really passionate about like educating people. Everything that you said, the stress, the diet, you know, all that, you know, is really, really paramount.
Perfect. So everybody reach out to Dr. Tara. And if you have friends or family who could benefit from her services, please send them to her as well. And again, I just want to thank you for your time. And I'm really glad that we got to discuss everything today. And I appreciate all your expertise and all your help with my patients. You've helped me a few times here. So it's been definitely a huge benefit for me. So I'm grateful to know you and have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. I'm glad to be here.
Well, everybody, share the podcast with friends and family, and we're signing off. Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.